Today, I'm excited to introduce my co-presenter, India Rackerson. She'll be talking about the legacy of the Iraq War. And Polly Toynbee will argue that Leavers and Remainers are finally united in opposition to Theresa May's Brexit deal.
For ordinary Iraqis who've lived through 15 years of violence and instability and economic poverty, this nightmare still hasn't come to an end.
So this is my house, actually, and I live here, and it's risk, actually, to live in this kind of neighbourhoods, but we have to take that risk.
2 years after Iraqi and US armies liberated the city of Fallujah from ISIS, some of the millions of displaced people are starting to return home, but it's far from safe. ISIS filled roads, fields and homes with thousands of improvised explosive devices.
They already planted IEDs even under the mattresses, under the floor tiles.
All over Iraq, casualties from these remaining homemade mines are rising. Iraq has seen wave after wave of violence since the US-led invasion in 2003. And the remnants of war are causing fear and disquiet.
The world needs not to take its eye off the ball. You can argue until the cows come home about the legitimacy of the invasion, but what's absolutely clear is that the consequences of it are still a mess.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rackerson. Today in Focus, after years of conflict, what does liberation really mean in Iraq?
I mean, you're very conscious of a continuing security threat. I mean, you still sense that it's a divided and troubled place that is just wondering whether it can be optimistic again.
Peter Beaumont is a senior reporter at The Guardian and has covered the conflict in Iraq since the beginning. And he was back in the country this week.
So the last few days I've been sort of revisiting Fallujah for the first time, well, since 2004.
Fallujah is a city about an hour's drive west of the capital, Baghdad.
You know, it's a very typical Iraqi city. I mean, it's very flat. It kind of runs into the desert. It's kind of a rundown place with a sort of industrial area of little metal workshops and things like that. I mean, it's got an awful lot of mosques and it's a very religious place. It sort of prides itself on its hospitality. But also it's got a reputation as having been one of those places that for quite a long time has been dangerous for foreigners to visit.
What was the situation like when you were last there?
The last time I was there, which was at the beginning of 2004, I think the situation was getting worse and worse. It was getting to be a place that was very difficult to visit. I mean, we ran into some people who didn't wish us very well, so we left in quite a hurry. And
didn't wish you well in what way?
Well, there were men with guns who wanted to come and talk to us, and we were fortunate. We were able to leave, but it was quite a frightening experience.
It was just over 90 minutes beyond President Bush's deadline for Saddam Hussein to leave Iraq, that U.S. warships and planes launched the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
BBC News special, the headlines. The attack on Iraq has begun. U.S. forces fired cruise missiles at Baghdad just before dawn.
Peter, take us back to 2003. After U.S. forces entered Baghdad, what happened in Fallujah?
In the period that followed the U.S.-led invasion, Fallujah became more and more restive. There was an incident in which some demonstrators were shot by US forces.
Iraqi blood spilt for the second time in 2 days here in Fallujah. Two dead and 14 injured after US troops opened fire on anti-American demonstrators. Ironically, the shooting happened at a march protesting against the deaths of 13 Iraqis killed at another march on Monday.
It became one of those places where, you know, the insurgency initially started and took off from. I mean, I think I last visited probably around a week after the American contractors had been killed in the city and their bodies hung from one of the bridges over the river there.
We're going to begin with Iraq this evening. Four American civilians were killed there today, and as sometimes happens, the cameras were there for the gruesome aftermath.
The four men were part of... From that period, it's kind of had this complex history of siding at times, or people inside the city siding with the original insurgents, then Al-Qaeda figures arrived in the city.
America's biggest enemy making its return tonight. And where? Iraq. Al-Qaeda taking over the very city...
After the two battles in 2004...
U.S. troops, along with 3,000 trained Iraqi soldiers, launch Operation Phantom Fury. The Second Battle of Fallujah begins.
You know, it continued to be a difficult place until after sort of 2007, 2008, when things began to quieten down a bit in Iraq. And then, it all began to erupt again around late 2012, not long before ISIS came onto the scene.
Allahu Akbar!
Fighters from the Al-Qaeda-linked Islamic State in the Levant claim they have taken over the main highway into the town of Fallujah.
To lose control of a town which was won at the cost of such intense fighting and so many American lives, and to lose it to an Al-Qaeda affiliate risks raising the question of what the whole war was for.
Okay, so at that point, the US had pretty much withdrawn from the war, and the UK too. But then right at the end of 2013, ISIS take control of Fallujah. Why do you think it was able to move in?
I think it managed to gain a foothold again because of the kind of cyclical political crisis, which is the Sunnis in Iraq felt extremely alienated and dissatisfied, and there was no real attempt to deal with the root causes of that alienation, and that made it easy for radicalisation to happen.
So, Peter, Fallujah was one of the very first cities to fall under control of ISIS, and ISIS's rule was, as we know, very brutal. And it was then 2 years before they were driven out by US and Iraqi forces.
And a senior Iraqi commander says the city of Fallujah has been liberated.
Well, Fallujah then is liberated in 2016 after a battle in the city. It was a pretty fierce battle. And one of the features of it was that, as in other places, ISIS had essentially dug in around what they called their caliphate and tried to hold ground. And part of holding that ground meant sort of building barrier minefields around the city. And in Fallujah's case, the belt minefields are probably about 15 kilometres long.
Wow, that's huge.
They are huge. When you go to the outskirts, that's where the fighting was most fierce. There's a sort of a complex of university buildings on the southern edge of Fallujah. And there's quite new neighbourhood called Shahada, which was being built in the sort of that area of kind of where the farmland meets the city, and there's sort of new breeze block houses. And when you go there now, this is where an awful lot of the destruction is. Almost every house is damaged or collapsed, and now when you walk around that, it's surrounded with marked minefields. The dirt roads have red painted bricks along them, marking out the safe passage. And then you have these, the skull and crossbone signs that you would imagine marking a minefield. And every now and then, you'll see a yellow painted bag of sand, which shows where an IED has actually been discovered, one of these homemade mines.
Have people returned home?
People have returned home. Across Iraq from the ISIS period and the conflicts before, at a height, there was something like 4 million people who were displaced.
Many of the 1,000 displaced Iraqis living in this camp.
Forced to flee, now forced to leave. The Iraqi government closes camps for people displaced by years of war.
These days, I think the latest figures I saw, it was about 1.8, 1.9 million people. So not everyone's returned, and into areas like Shahada, which were on the front lines, the returns have been much more limited than, say, the centre of the city. People are still living in other places.
Peter, you're back in Fallujah now because of this growing issue with homemade explosive devices, and they're a big part of why people are not returning to their homes. So what are these devices like?
I first came across one of these things personally in Afghanistan around 2010. Typically what you would find is like a plastic jerry can, which has either had cooking oil or some other thing inside it. That's stuffed with explosives. I mean, what's really shocking about these things is the Cold War era anti-personnel mines that you think of have a few hundred grams of explosives in them. It's enough to take your foot off. These things can have kilos of explosives in and quite dirty explosives. So if you step on one of these things and survive, you're likely to suffer multiple amputations. You could lose all your limbs if you survive.
And these devices aren't just being laid in roads and fields, are they?
No, I mean, these devices were laid everywhere. I spoke to one resident and he said, you know, they're under vegetable patches, under fields, they're in culverts used to irrigate the fields, they were put under tiles and sometimes put under floor mattresses. Under mattresses, yes.
That's absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, and these are the more standard ones. I mean, they were also making these complicated booby traps that would be, they would detonate from a tripwire or you move a pan or just a household object and even children's toys.
Oh.
You know, people are afraid. I mean, the reason that quite a lot of people haven't returned to the Shahada neighbourhood is because they're afraid. And in Fallujah's case, I mean, it's like 2 years on, people are very, very constrained in what they're able to do until they know that someone has come through and cleared it. Initially, there was one gentleman I met who was the first person to go back.
You know, like, as I told you before, I'm the first family, you know, or the first man who come back again to the neighborhood here. You know, the second one, actually family came back again here after 6 months from my, you know, return time. But I have some.
He's
some,
finished rebuilding his house, although he has sort of a red minefield marker running through his vegetable patch.
Right through it.
So you walk into his garden and there's a kind of some things planted and you can see where the sort of the cleared area actually runs through just a bit of his garden. I mean, he was prevented from returning for quite a while by the Iraqi security forces, who thought it was too dangerous. But he doesn't have anywhere else to go because he doesn't have the funds to live anywhere else. And so in the end, he decided he'd come back and rebuild his house.
What would be the alternative for somebody like him?
Well, the alternative would be to live as a displaced person being supported. But he didn't want to do that. He wanted to live in his own house.
Come back home.
Come back home, yeah, exactly. Like all of us would, I think.
So what does all of this mean for normal life?
Kids are back at school now. There's a school there, opened on October the 1st. They were being taught in caravans before that. But since the cleared routes were opened by the Halo Trust and marked, I mean, children have been able to go back to school. But I mean, I have to say, it felt pretty surreal. You know, you have these mine warning signs everywhere. And then, you know, in the middle of all this, a nice new UN school that's full of kids being taught. I mean, to give you a sense of it, every Thursday of the week, they have kind of like a weekly assembly. And at that assembly, they kind of hammer home the message, be careful. Every week, the kids in this school are told about the dangers of the devices in the fields.
A lot of these IEDs are being cleared by organisations and charities on the ground, using big machines with long arms that trawl through the earth. But it is a slow process. Iraq has fallen out of the headlines, and the clearing up of mines isn't getting the attention or the funding it received during the big campaigns in the 90s. So if these devices aren't cleared up, Peter, then what happens to people?
The real legacy is a legacy in terms of people being afraid, people not being able to work, not being able to be economically active, being angry, and this kind of risk that the slower the process is and the longer that it goes on, the greater the risk of people becoming alienated and radicalised again. I mean, bear in mind that Fallujah was one of the first cities to be taken back from ISIS. You go up to Mosul, it was much more recent, and you go further west towards the Syrian border, and there's still fighting going on there, and people haven't even been able to do a landmine assessment yet. It should not be an impossible job to clear these and get people back to work, get people back to their houses. But the longer they're away, the longer they're too frightened to come back, you know, the bigger the social impact. That's the real risk in somewhere like Fallujah at the moment, is that it pushes people back towards that sort of sense of anger and alienation.
Fallujah has seen many battles and occupation by ISIS as well. Do you think it would consider itself liberated?
I mean, I think liberated is a very loaded word. I don't know. I mean, what does liberation mean in terms of a conflict like this? I think what most people would seek is kind of a sense of full citizenship and a return to normality. That would be liberating, to use the word in a different way, for people in Fallujah.
Do you think if these IEDs aren't cleared up, if cities aren't sort of returned to economic stability, there's a chance that ISIS could come back?
Oh, it could be ISIS, it could be something else. I mean, history doesn't always repeat itself in the same way. But you know, if this isn't done rapidly, this could lead to a renewed radicalisation once again.
Peter, thank you so much. In December last year, the Iraqi government declared victory over ISIS. But they haven't completely left. The night after we spoke to Peter, two Iraqis working with the Halo Trust to clear mines in Fallujah were killed with seven other people. The attack seems to have been carried out by militants aligned with ISIS, evidence of the continuing danger in a still unstable country. You can keep up with all of Peter Beaumont's reporting on Iraq at theguardian.com. Coming up next in Opinion, Polly Toynbee reflects on an extraordinary moment for the future of Britain. Welcome back. Last night, Prime Minister Theresa May finally emerged from 10 Downing Street to announce that her cabinet will back her Brexit deal.
I believe that what I owe to this country is to take decisions that are in the national interest. And I firmly believe, with my head and my heart, that this is a decision which is in the best interests of our entire United Kingdom.
For Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, this is the next big moment in what has been the most unpredictable political event she's ever covered.
I always have a great sense of excitement about what's going to happen next, and there's never been a more exciting, though I think frightening, time in politics than now. There's an earthquake, a political earthquake going on, and we don't quite know how it'll fall out. We are in an extraordinary situation where suddenly people who have been absolutely at loggerheads, the arch remainers, the arch leavers, are all united, all singing out of the same hymn sheet. They've all got their guns pointed at Theresa May's deal, and yet they come from entirely opposite ends of the political spectrum. I think it makes it very threatening for her. Before, they were making quite different arguments about what the future would look like. Now they're united that the one thing they don't want the future to look like is her deal. The idea that somehow we would be a sovereign parliament, free to make all our own rules, we've ended up in the absolute opposite situation where all rules are made elsewhere and we have no say in them. The honest slogan now wouldn't be taking back control, but giving away all control. I think everyone in the country looks at Theresa May with a certain astonishment, whatever their politics. How does the woman stick at it? How does she take all of this flak non-stop? Physically, it's most exhausting. She's flying around the world all the time, dealing with hundreds of different things. She's got diabetes, and there is something about her that is remarkable. She has stickability. She seems to be impervious to criticism, which is in some ways a bad thing because it means she doesn't really avoid the obstacles in her path. She could have seen all this coming 2 years ago. They sold it as being something that was going to be the easiest deal in history, Liam Fox said, and it's turned out to be the most difficult. And as a result, I think it's made a lot of people very frustrated and disillusioned with the process of politics. I think nearly all the journalists I know covering this great Brexit debate are, each of them, passionately personally involved on one side or the other of the argument. But nevertheless, we all have that element of saying we have never covered anything like this in our lifetimes. There has never been a drama quite like this. the excitement day by day, the twists and turns, the who will resign, what's going to happen next, can she possibly get a majority, will there be a general election, what happens next? And nobody knows. We sit around saying to each other, do you know, any idea? Nobody has a clue. There may be complete chaos. There may be a breakdown of our whole political system such as we haven't seen before, not in my lifetime.
You can follow Polly's reporting and the unfolding Brexit events on The Guardian's live blog at theguardian.com. And if you're liking Today in Focus, please review, share and subscribe. And then we can be with you every weekday. Lucky you. That's it for this episode. My thanks to Peter Beaumont and Polly Toynbee. Today's producers were Mithili Rao and Rachel Humphreys, with sound design by Axel Cacoutier. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.